This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking at earlier acts of terrorism against the United States to see what clues they offer about last week's attacks. My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. He covered the first trial related to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Terrorists planned to follow that attack by blowing up several New York landmarks, including the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels and the United Nations. But that plot was discovered and foiled. Blumenthal covered the conspiracy trial in 1995, which ended with the convictions of a blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who headed a radical fundamentalist mosque in New Jersey, and his co-conspirators. Ralph Blumenthal has also covered organized crime for the New York Times and currently writes about arts and culture. I spoke with him earlier today. What are some of the major connections you see between the first World Trade Center bombing and last week's attack, connections that might help us understand what happened last week?
Well, the important thing to understand, Terry, is it is one war that we've been fighting against terrorism really from 1990. It's come in different forms and not always been recognized. But, for example, World Trade Center 1, as we now unfortunately look back on it, also relied on a small group of very secretive extremists who used all the trappings of spy craft, secret meetings and coded telephone calls and false identities. And the links actually persist, if not the same players, to the current plot.
Are there any people connected to the first World Trade Center bombing who seem to be connected to last week's attacks?
The simple answer is no, because they're in jail. And from jail, where they are around the country in maximum security prisons, they have no opportunity to communicate. So the actual people who participated in or carried out the first World Trade Center attack are no longer on the scene. Okay, but there are links because it's a complicated world of relationships. There are links between the first World Trade Center attack and even plots predating that, and the current attacks.
And what are those links?
The links really go through this Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who is now in prison. Who was the leader, as a jury determined, of the attack, first attack on the World Trade Center, a subsequent foiled attack, a series of attacks on New York City landmarks, and his spiritual guidance, really, or terroristic guidance, that lay behind Osama bin Laden, who is now believed to be the mastermind behind the latest attacks. So there's really a continuum of people. It's like a relay race. The same people don't appear at the beginning, at the end, but they're in touch with people who are in touch with people who end up doing the final, the most recent attacks.
So the Sheikh Rahman was an inspiration to bin Laden?
He was, and one of the reasons given for bin Laden's terrorism activities is that he was angered over the prosecution of the Sheikh.
The prosecution of the Sheikh subsequent to the World Trade Center bombing of 93?
The prosecution of the Sheikh, right, in the World Trade Center bombing, and particularly in this plot to blow up the Holland and Lincoln Tunnel and the UN and various other landmarks in New York.
Do you know how much is known about the relationship that they've had, bin Laden and the Sheikh?
I don't know, because they really come from different parts of the Arab world. The Sheikh is Egyptian, and he was actually tried and acquitted in the assassination of President Sadat of Egypt. Bin Laden's background is Saudi Arabian, but they came together, at least ideologically, in the same war on America.
Now let's get to the foiled plot. You covered the trial on of the leaders of this foiled plot. What was the plot?
The plot was really chilling. It was to stall some cars in the Holland and Lincoln Tunnel. The cars would be packed with high explosives, as the truck was that blew up the World Trade Center shortly before it. The people driving these cars would have 10 or 15 minutes to get out of the tunnel. Traffic would, of course, back up in the tunnel. The tunnels would explode and water rush in and everybody would be drowned. This attack was to have been coordinated with an attack on the United Nations and other landmarks, including, they talked about, the Empire State Building, Grand Central Terminal, Times Square, predominantly Jewish jewelry district. So it was a very wide-ranging plot.
What did you learn during the coverage of the trial of how this conspiracy was foiled?
Well, it was foiled by something that the government unfortunately did not have in any of the later cases, which is a very high-level mole or informant directly in the plot. This man was an Egyptian intelligence agent, a very enigmatic character himself, who claimed to have had prior knowledge of the First World Trade Center attack. Anyway, he had penetrated this group. He became very close to Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman and was able to record conversations. He was actually in the tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, with some of the conspirators at the time they were planning the attack, and he had that on tape.
And so exactly when did the government intercede to stop the plot?
It was up to 6 months after the World Trade Center attack. The first World Trade Center attack was February 26, 1993. The foiled attack, or the would-be attack on the bridges and the UN, was to have taken place several months thereafter in what we now know is a sort of a 1-2 punch strategy of these terrorists. So it was to have taken place shortly after the World Trade Center attack. But this time, at least, the government was aware of the plot every step of the way. And in a very dramatic part of the story, they seized the conspirators in the process of mixing explosives in a warehouse in Queens. They were actually preparing the bomb.
What did you learn about the Sheikh's motivation in wanting to blow up New York landmarks and murder so many people?
Well, the first thing about the Sheikh is it's very interesting, like bin Laden, he was very careful to maintain an outward distance. He was very, very careful not to say anything publicly that would indicate he was behind this or encouraging these attacks. But he was convicted on testimony and taped conversations that showed very subtle backing or direction that he was giving underlings and giving them sort of spiritual guidance that this is what was demanded of them, this would be permissible. In terms of his motivation, he was part of the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Egypt. They've had a long-running war with the secular government of Egypt, it really grew out of the battle going on in Egypt that was being carried over here. Abdelrahman, for example, tried to recruit this informer to kill President Mubarak of Egypt when he was visiting New York. So it really grew out of ideological strife in Egypt.
You've covered the mafia in New York,
right.
And you've also covered terrorism trials, two really different kinds of operations. But there are some similarities in that in both you're looking for informers if you could get them. There's a code of secrecy. It's hard to get people to testify against their own. Can you talk about some of the similarities differences?
It is curious that there is a parallel. I just noticed today that the terrorists had a way of changing the spellings of their names, which is not that unusual considering they're often transliterated from the Arabic. But one of the old techniques of the mafia dons and soldiers was to change their names periodically, just a letter or two here or there, which meant that all the files weren't concentrated in the same place, that they were spread, you know, among three or four different spellings of the names. So we see that here, that it really makes the job of tracking them much more difficult. They use terror among themselves, on each other, to force associates to submit to very rigorous discipline. There is the code among the, you know, the omerta, the code of secrecy among, you know, that they pledge to enforce their conspiracy with death. So, you know, there's not that much difference in the methodology and the just the way they go about things.
What are some of the differences in the tools that the federal government has to go after the mafia versus going after terrorists?
Well, the mafia, you know, they have the government was in a very good position to penetrate the mafia because they had a lot of Italian-American agents. We've had a lot of experience in so many years of watching organized, traditional organized crime, that the government had gotten some very remarkable people like you know, Joe Pistone and the Donnie Brasco story, who actually lived as a high level, you know, mafioso inside the mob for 5 years. We don't have that, as far as I can see, with the terrorist cells. When I covered the World Trade Center 1, it was clear that the government had a great shortage of Arabic speaking FBI agents who could penetrate. So that's probably the biggest single thing. We don't have the intelligence. Sadly, we see the evidence of it now.
My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. He covered the first trial related to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and he covered the thwarted conspiracy to blow up New York landmarks. You know, I've been asking you to try to make connections between previous terrorist plots and last week's attacks. Any other connections you'd like to make for us?
Yeah, there's one very big one. In 1990, the leader of the Jewish Defense League, Meir Kahane, was assassinated in New York. And at the time, the attack was seen as an isolated extremist attack by a Muslim fanatic named El Said Nosseir, who was convicted of a weapons violation, of having a gun. It was a strange jury verdict. Anyway, he turned out to be the center, or a center, of the World Trade Center conspiracy originally to bomb the World Trade Center. And he had terrorist links to many of the groups that are showing up and showed up since then in terrorist plots against the city, including the foiled plot to blow up the Hudson River tunnels and the UN. This was a missed connection, we all now realize, as far back as 1990. And he's now in jail. He was convicted and is serving a long sentence. But the inability to see that that assassination was really one of literally the opening gun in a 10 or 12 year war that is still going on is one of the big intelligence failures.
You work at the Arts and Culture unit of the New York Times now. What aspects of the terrorism story are you still pursuing?
Well, I'm helping out on the intelligence part of it. We're still trying to piece together the pictures of the conspirators, and that's really the hardest part of the story because they've left very few clues. I mean, there are a lot of impacts of the story on the cultural life. I had a story the other day on how building projects, including the reconstruction of Lincoln Center, which was to have been probably the largest cultural project in the nation's history, $1.5 billion plan to revive and renovate Lincoln Center, is probably going to be stalled, if not totally junked now, because of the need to put resources in Lower Manhattan. A lot of other projects are going to be stalled. A lot of plays and books have been held back now because the subject matter is deemed inappropriate at this time. The ramifications are just getting wider and wider. Somebody said the other day that the people who were saving the newspaper of the attack were really on the wrong track. The paper that everyone should save is the paper of September 11th, which is the last day of the old world. Everything is different now.
What were some of the things that went through your mind, having covered terrorist trials and realizing probably pretty quickly that this was an act of terrorism?
Well, my first thought was, oh, no, not again. Because the first one was a hellish experience, just from the standpoint, you know, quite apart from the death and destruction. And remember, the first attack, we only had 6 dead and 1,000 or so injured. I say only. Which seem very paltry numbers now against this tragedy. But it was a hellish experience to cover because, again, we were dealing with a lot of shadows. It was a very competitive story to cover. Everybody was running around. A lot of rumors were floated. We didn't have the experience that we have now, actually, on how to cover these kind of stories and where to look. So in that sense, we're a little better off today because we do have sort of a framework now.
What are some of the more practical things you learned during covering the trials about how the terrorist cells operate, their methods?
First of all, like the mafia, they're not always as good as they try to be. They make a lot of mistakes, thankfully, they certainly have to talk, you know, the mafia has to talk to plan their activities and figure out what they're going to do with the money. So they have to have meetings, they have to talk on the phone, whether it's in code or not, and so do these guys. And every time they make a phone call, they leave a track. And there are phone records that are very, very helpful on establishing these connections. So that's the one thing you see, that even the best laid, you know, plots have big flaws. Now, in World Trade Center 1, the huge breakthrough was finding within days of the explosion the truck chassis that carried the chassis of the truck that carried the bomb into the World Trade Center garage, and that, with the identification number on it, led to the car rental company Ryder, and they could trace it to the particular office that rented the car and the people who rented it. So right away, within days, they had that connection, and that was not something that the conspirators ever thought would happen that quickly. Here, too, in this case, they have found obviously the manifests of the planes and some of the, they found a passport already. And as soon as they have this list of names, they're going back over their residences, their circle of acquaintances, the telephone records. What we're learning is that the FBI can move with great speed in putting these putting the picture together once they have a little evidence to go on.
Now you mentioned that the conspiracy to blow up New York landmarks was foiled because there was an insider who spoke to federal agents. Do you know what his motivation was? Did that come out during the trial?
Imad Salem, the Egyptian intelligence officer who had penetrated this group, partly it was financial. He was looking for $1 million payoff, which he got, I believe.
He got it from the feds?
Yep. And this is often the attraction for people who turn on their associates. That's why they put out these huge rewards. Often with these turncoats, they enjoy the game. They like the excitement of being a double agent or an undercover agent, and so there's a sort of a psychological thrill to it all for them, especially since the stakes are so high. I mean, if they're unmasked, they face death. So he was a complicated character, and in his case. But, other people turned, too, during the trial. Two of the people facing charges in the Landmarks plot turned government witness and testified against their cohorts. So it did happen a few times.
It seems that the FBI and the CIA have some tough choices to make in terms of who they're going to put on the payroll for information, people who might still be terrorists, who might still be working against
them. Yeah, those are very unpalatable choices. And just as they they take mafia informants, people who've been involved in murders. Look at Sammy the Bull. He became the darling of the prosecutors because he turned against John Gotti, and he himself had killed, I believe, 11 people or more, 19. The count keeps changing. So these are tough choices that the government has to face all the time, and And we're used to that in our society. You have to deal with these people because ordinary law-abiding citizens don't have this information. They're not privy to it. So you have to deal with the people who are in the middle of it. You know, one of the really interesting choices that the government had to make in the case of the informer and the Landmarks case was whether to bring him out to testify or to leave him undercover. He wanted to stay undercover. He didn't want to be exposed as a witness. But there was a big argument over that, and the forces that made him into a witness to testify won. That had certain consequences, and perhaps if he'd stayed undercover, he might have exposed this plot. We don't know.
Ralph Blumenthal, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ralph Blumenthal is a reporter for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. This is Fresh Air.